All right, you're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Bon Appetit editor-at-large Christine Mulkey sits down with the author of the novel Sweet Bitter, Stephanie Dandler, who writes about the glamorous world of New York City restaurants. Except it ain't that glamorous if you've ever been a waiter or a waitress at one of them. It's a really fun read, and Christine and Stephanie talk about that. So let's do this. Christine Mulkey, Stephanie Dandler.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us from LA. Sweet Bitter is a fascinating look behind the scenes at one of New York's most famous restaurants. What made you want to write about your experience there, and how did you remember everything in such detail? I mean, when I was a waitress, it was all a blank by the next day.
People often ask me how autobiographical the book is, and my first response is, I don't remember anything about being 22. You're working in a restaurant, you're not sleeping, you're drinking heavily, you're partaking in the lifestyle. And also, it's like that was over 10 years ago at this point. I have notes from that period of time, and a certain song will take me back. And strangely enough, I've always collected menus of places that I've eaten. So I have a lot of menus from that moment in time in New York City. But other than that, Tess's experience, the protagonist of the novel, it's fiction. It's invented. As far as why I wanted to write about that, I think the impulse to write a female coming-of-age novel came first, and then the coming-to-New-York novel was also primary. And then, as I was thinking of ways to tell that story, I'd been in the restaurant business for 7 years at that point. I knew this world. I knew its mechanisms. I knew the characters and the voices. And once I started listening to those voices, it came together very quickly. And then once I settled on the metaphor of the palate, not just for learning about food and wine, but for tasting all of these experiences like friendship and intimacy and lust and urban environments, once I settled on that, it all unraveled from there. And not effortlessly by any means. It's writing a novel. It's fraught and miserable, but I saw the arc of the book fairly quickly after that.
That's so great. So you said you were taking notes. Were you like a New York Times food critic going in the bathroom and scribbling things down when you were working?
No, and I would think to myself, you waited tables before.
Yes.
I would think to myself, I need to write that down. And then I'd be having my shift drink and I would think, wait, what happened tonight? What day of the week is it? I had no recollection. But then when I was writing and when I could get myself into kind of the tunnel that is writing fiction, where you're making things up and you have all this freedom, voices came back to me. I mean, I think particularly in the sections where it's just bits of dialogue and kind of overheard conversation very quickly. That's all true. I did not write it down. I don't know how I remembered it, but just once I got into a certain mindset, it kind of bubbled back up the way that memories do.
That's great. I mean, you capture so many things so well in the book, not only what it's like to wait tables and that kind of just that adrenaline wash or that fear spike, but then all of the details that you have to be on top of, but also just the personality wars that are, you know, going on.
Yeah.
Not only just between front and back of house, you capture that so well. Also, it's so great how you're able to talk about moving to New York and being a complete outsider and becoming an actual cool person.
Trying. I mean, it's so nice that Tess is cool. Maybe I'm cool too. No one knows.
Well, you learn the language, certainly.
So, right, the entire book, all she's doing is learning a language. She's learning a language for Sancerre. She's learning a language for oysters. She's learning a language of how to pass in New York City. And that's sort of where I think the story becomes universal, because I think people that don't work in the restaurant industry love to peek inside, but they'll never get it. I just don't think that you can. But we all came to this city, or we all have moved somewhere where we've had to be initiated and we've had these rites of passage and we've had to learn the new language, and we're different people with new names and new identities at the end. And I think that is very true for every New Yorker, that you kind of start over and you have to learn and start from zero when you get here.
Right. And it's almost like studying. I mean, you did, Tess did study.
Yeah, of course. And that's also unique to New York. I started in restaurants when I was 15 years old. I was a hostess.
Oh my gosh, where?
At Walt's Wharf in Seal Beach, California.
Wow.
Wonderful seafood restaurant on the main street. And I was enthralled by it, and I've never worked anywhere else or had any kind of job besides the restaurant industry. However, when I got to New York City with a Zagat guide and decided, which I didn't know how to read, speaking of not knowing the language, I was like, what is this book? How is this? What is this? What are all these numbers? This is so confusing. But I saw most popular restaurants, and I thought, okay, great. I'll drop off resumes at each one of them.
Wow.
I've been working in a coffee shop for years. They're going to be dying to have me. That was not true. But the level of professionalism and expertise that I encountered at every restaurant, and especially my first job was at Union Square Cafe, especially at Danny Meyer's restaurants, the job went so far beyond clocking in and clocking out. There were ethics involved. There was a philosophy. There were these families that were being created that seemed to have an extra layer of meaning beyond the kind of like fast-paced, I'm here, but I'm really doing this other thing. The people that I met at Union Square Cafe were doing that and leading very full, meaningful lives with children and vacations and benefits, and this was their career, and they're making incredible money. And that I had never encountered before, the fact that I had to study and that the world, as I got further into it, was richer and richer. It kept giving back to me.
Amazing. And is there anything from the Danny Meyer playbook that you still apply to your life?
The ultimate teacher, Danny Meyer. From working for him and being so close to so many people that did, I think what he's identifying is an empathy. He is looking for people with like a deep sense of self-awareness and compassion. And what that translates to when you get into service is that they're better at anticipating needs, which is what real hospitality is about, being mm-hmm. able to identify what someone wants and needs before they've even formulated the thought. And so I feel like I have carried that's helped me in every aspect of my life. You could call it reading people, you could call it empathy, but this sort of ability to anticipate needs is great for any industry, for any individual, which is why so many people that work for Danny Meyer go on to such a myriad of fields.
Right. So what do I want right now?
Would you like some tea?
I'd love some. Oh my God, how did you know? So Sweet Bitter is a not very thinly account of working at Union Square Cafe, and yet you don't say that.
Because it is a novel and it is fiction, right. And I've worked at so many restaurants in New York City. I was at Union Square Cafe for a year and a half, but I've been all over. And I really treasured the freedom that I had when I was writing to make my restaurant a restaurant. Like, I'm thinking in all capitals when I see that word. And I wanted it to be based on Union Square Cafe, but not beholden to it. I didn't want to write a memoir, partly because I think I'd be terrible at it, partly because I don't remember anything. I had no interest in that. I had so much interest in the restaurant as a setting, but not as a historical account of mm-hmm. something of a Danny Meyer restaurant. So obviously, and things happen in the novel that never happened in Union Square Cafe. And that's the fun of being a novelist and not a memoirist, right. is that I got to play.
That's great. And were you already a writer when you were working there? Did you move here to
be
a writer?
I was, yeah, I did. I moved here to be a writer. I graduated from a school in Ohio called Kenyon, with a degree in creative writing and like really beautiful, grandiose, naive ideas about taking New York City by storm.
Which you did. It just took 10
a
years.
A decade, yeah.
That's really fast.
Stop. No, I moved here and I thought that I would write I thought maybe I would work in publishing. I didn't quite understand about supporting myself here, which I learned very quickly. And I still had a writing practice, you know, I handwrite every day, really mundane, horrible things that no one will ever read. But it's more of a meditation.
Do you write in the morning?
Yeah, I do. I do with coffee. And I thought that I would keep it up, but I did have the experience of falling in love with the restaurant industry, seeing it as a viable profession, and I followed it. I stayed with it. I went to wine school. I became the beverage director for restaurants. Then I was the GM, and I helped open places.
Wow.
And it was a very full, as I saw when I went to Union Square Cafe, I was having this very full, enriched life. And I didn't want for anything except for the fact that I was a writer, and I never wanted to be anything but a writer.
How did you manage to write? Because waiting tables is so exhausting.
It is exhausting, and I didn't really write when I was managing. That is a 70 to 80 an hour work week, and is a total brain. It takes your entire brain to run restaurants and to manage people and to put out fires constantly. And then when I went back to school and I went back to waiting tables, I worked 4 days a week at Bouvette and went to school 3 days a week. And the method I had is kind of the method I still have, where when I was writing, I did nothing else but write. I didn't go out to lunch. I didn't wash my hair. I didn't do laundry. I ordered Seamless. I did nothing else but write. And then when the weekend came, and I was working till 4 a.m. at Bouvette because, you know, they're open quite late and then you're cleaning up. I did not write. I didn't open a book. I would take walks. But so much of your body and your brain are taken up by that kind of work that it felt like once I turned that switch on, they're just two separate switches. I still have not fully integrated living and writing. I'm pretty much doing one or the other.
I think only Stephen King and, Balzac, but that didn't,
I always think of Virginia Woolf has this diary entry, and she says that she writes for 3 hours in the morning, has a lunch, writes for 3 hours in the afternoon, 6 days a week, and takes one day off. And I thought, oh, when I stop waiting tables, that's going to be me. I'm going to be on this regimented daytime schedule and so structured. And no, I still write in these binges and then live in binges as well.
And you mentioned coffee. Do you have any other sort of food or drink rituals around writing?
Everything. I think that beverages are so important for writers because you have to get up. You're a writer. You can't you cannot just sit. So it's, I really love green tea for that kind of slow stimulation and the fact that you can refill your cup so many times and pace around the house. I do switch to white wine, but that is very tricky balance. The 1 to 2 glasses is fantastic. And then after the 2 glasses, you think that you're God and you think that you're writing poetry and it's just kind of, you're useless after that. Beverages the whole time.
Any snack foods? I'm a popcorn writer.
Really?
Yeah.
People who are into popcorn, that's like their religion. It's not me. No, I wish it was because I'm afraid mine is cheese and bread and cornichons, terrible.
Fantastic.
For you.
No. So where else did you work and what did each place teach you about food and wine?
I worked for Moni Dawes, who owns Tia Paul, for many, many years. She had a wine store called Tinto Fino and she had a wine bar called El Quinto Pino, and her husband has had Char Number 4 and now has Maysville. And so I was her person, and I'm still very close with her, for a long time. I didn't jump around too much, but through her I had a variety of restaurant experiences. And Moni taught me about wine. She sent me to WSET, which is a wine school, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. She sent me to Spain biannually, sometimes triannually.
Wow.
Just incredible benefits to working this crazy schedule, but a lot of time to eat and to experience. And the lunches that she was a big believer in R&D, research and development, for her management staff. And I think that's how you retain good people.
And if you could go anywhere in Spain right now to eat and drink, where would you go?
Huge fan of Barcelona, huge fan of San Sebastian. Galicia is the next place. Mm. The seafood in on the coastline of Galicia, it's one of the most like biodiverse oceans in the world. And you have like the gooseneck barnacles and the crazy oysters and the octopus and prepared 1,000 different ways. And the region's known for Albariño, but in Ribera Sacra, this was such a fun question. In Ribera Sacra, which is one of the few red wine producing regions there, mm-hmm. they're working with Mencia, and it's this like almost like a Gamay. It's high acid, lower alcohol, really drinkable, but also complex. And I think those wines are so fun. Mm. And it's kind of like a haunted part of Spain. It rains 300 days a year. It looks like Ireland. It's freezing. And they wear kilts. And
wow. I was about to ask you to write this for next year's travel issue. Maybe you should quit while you're ahead. No kidding.
And nothing else. I must see it again in order to remember.
I still want to go. I love a kilt.
Yes. But yeah, it's nothing like Castilian Spain. Really special, special portion of the country.
Great. And are those wines that make it to the U.S.?
Yeah, they do. I mean, obviously in smaller quantities. Galicia is known for Albariño, which you see kind of a lot. Yeah, smaller production.
Great. And so what did you learn working at Bouvet? I mean, Jody is such an inspiring person and she hires really creative young people. What was it like to be around that environment?
Oh, God. I'm just such a Jody fan. I have followed her career since Mirandi a million years ago. And then I used to go to Gotino and I had her Brandad once and I was like, I'll follow this woman to the ends of the earth. It was the only restaurant I applied to when I was going to go back to waiting tables. I kind of was making that transition begrudgingly. And so I just applied to one restaurant and Corinne, her general manager, hired me on the spot for these great shifts. Hmm. And I was like, okay, this is meant to be. I mean, Jody is, I mean, she's a genius as far as cooking goes. And her level of perfectionism is intense mm-hmm. in the way of all great chefs. But what I really appreciate about her is how she trusts her instincts. She's such an instinctual person and fearless as far as I'm going to go open this restaurant in Paris right. and I don't care what anyone thinks about it. And I've got all of this going on, but I'm going to open Via Carota because that space opened up across the street.
Right.
And this level of detail. And I think that most people go into Bouvet and think, it's gorgeous. It's stunning. The food is delicious. But the silverware, the teacups, the way the books are stacked in the bookshelf, the music that she's playing. She even kind of curates her staff mm-hmm. as far as who she wants on the floor. And that level of detail is why her restaurants are so popular. Not to mention, like, she's not afraid of flavor.
Right. So what is universally relatable about your book?
Oh,
I mean, you certainly didn't tame the drinking, drugs, and sex.
Well, it's funny because maybe that's not universally relatable. And I've been thinking about that as I've been doing interviews, because I think to myself, that's what every 22-year-old does. Maybe that is not the case. The people that are drawn to the restaurant industry tend to like this, I mean, what you used the word adrenaline earlier, this adrenalized lifestyle, they tend to favor the most intense version of any of whatever the substance is, even if it's a fish. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is universally relatable. I do think there's something about the food industry that, like, you're a tribe, really. I think the idea of moving here and being utterly lost and not knowing, especially as a young woman, and I hope that men read this book and I hope they love this book, but the experience of being a young woman and not knowing how to draw boundaries around yourself yet and wanting so much but not being able to distinguish between the good and the bad, mm-hmm. that is what I find people relate to across the board.
Right. So you write so beautifully about food and wine, and those are actually two very difficult things to write about, spoken like a true editor. How did you go about doing that, and what did you want to avoid? What are the cliches of writing about food?
So I'm obsessed with MFK Fisher, and I feel like I'm repeating myself because in every interview I do, I'm saying something about her, but The Gastronomical Me is such a foundational book as far as seeming to be about food, but actually being about becoming a woman mm-hmm. and marriage and heartbreak and grief and isolation. And I find every time I'm reading it that I think that I'm reading about pea soup on an ocean liner, but I'm in tears. And I think I learned what you can do by telling a story about food. Food is a metaphor for transformation. And then I also I read a lot of poetry. Mm. And there are two poems that I kept kind of tacked to my board while I was working on this. And one is Oysters by Seamus Heaney. And the other is an Untitled by Frank O'Hara that begins, "Light, clarity, avocado salad in the morning." And I think that what those poems reminded me of is that most of the time food in literature is a detail. It's a character tick. It's part of the atmosphere. It's part of setting the scene. But in these two poems, food is how you become present. It is the hinge of like that transcendent moment, or it provides the gateway to an epiphany. So it's essential. It's not a detail. It is actually the mode in which you're telling the story. And so anytime I was writing about food writing, this gets so flowery and you get so lost and you get so far away from the fact that you're consuming something, and I needed it to be essential. So I tried to keep it very close to her, very close to Tess, and it had to be necessary to her story in order to make it into the book. I have so many food scenes I threw away.
Oh,
maybe
no.
I'll use them again someday, but yeah, it had to be really necessary.
Great, and the wine writing is wonderful too.
I mean, that's so fun. It's just so fun. And the funny thing is when you learn about wine, you learn this language and you learn how to say, this is red fruit, this is black fruit, this is cooked fruit, this is dried fruit. And then the more you learn, the less those words mean. You're mm-hmm. just tasting something that's burgundy, period. And it tastes like burgundy, period. And I think that's part of like that tricky concept of terroir, where you can't really talk about what you're experiencing, but trying to is really fun.
Right. We did a podcast with Jancis Robinson, and I mean, she's so incredible. She's been doing this for 40 years.
Oh, she's
and
a goddess.
I mean, on a weekly basis, she's writing across at least 4 platforms and describing, you know, she drinks 150 plus wines a week, and she has to put them into words in order to tell people, you know, who they can relate enough to say, should I buy this? And just the adjectives in that woman's mind are incredible.
Oh, yeah. She's prolific.
And she's still curious and she's still excited. And, you know, wine has that power. So when you come back to New York from Los Angeles, where do you eat first?
The best question.
We all have that touchstone.
Yeah. I think it definitely, I'm a solo Grand Central Oyster Bar girl. And it's very special to me. And it's that anonymity that I love so much, and also the feeling of people that are going places and this kind of freedom that you get from being in a train station, but then you're having oysters. But I love the places in the city where you feel like you could disappear. Maybe because I've been in the restaurant industry so long, there aren't that many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like working at a Danny Meyer restaurant is kind of like the Mickey Mouse Club. Like you go into any restaurant and you're like, hey, knew you from 10 years ago. Oh, hey, you're married to so-and-so. It's just like everyone knows each other at this point.
Right.
So Grand Central Oyster Bar, definitely.
And what's your standing order there?
Oh, I just get a dozen and then a lobster roll. And I usually let them pick. I'm partial to East Coast oysters. I really love salt. in general.
And what do you drink with that?
For the price that they have a Chablis by the glass that is quite lovely. Other than that, I'm at Bouvet all the time, and they probably hate me because I'm just always there. I go to Marlowe a lot. Marlowe and Sons. Also like to eat at the bar there.
Great.
Yeah.
Oysters.
Where
did you go to celebrate when you sold the book?
Oh, my God. Gramercy, obviously. I went to Gramercy Tavern immediately. I guess all of my spots are spots where you can sit at the bar by yourself, which is such a special part of living in New York. Mm-hmm. Who did I meet? I met my agent. I met my best friend. We had champagne. Suzanne Gowen was there. Like, ooh. I don't even know her, but I just like saw her down the bar and I was like, oh, this is a sign. This is such a good day. Suzanne's eating here too. I was a psycho fan and had a burger. And I was a very happy woman, happy girl.
Fantastic. And so now that the word is out, I mean, you had a fantastic deal. How do your former colleagues, when you go to a restaurant, how do they treat you?
Oh, I mean, they tolerate me. No, I have had so many restaurant families, and they're all so happy, and they're all so excited to read the book. And the ones that have read the book, yeah, it's a lot of joy.
Great.
And we celebrate a lot, and I still see everyone when I'm here.
And when you were waiting tables, what did you wish that people who hadn't waited tables knew or did differently? Like, what do people always F up?
What I wish they knew is that a human being was waiting on them and not not a robot or a pet mm-hmm. that you can snap at. And I guess I do. I wish they knew to trust me. I wish that instead of that California Chardonnay that they are so sure that they want, they would try a weird Chardonnay from the Loire that's unfiltered, and or even try a glass of sherry before the dinner started. And I'm obviously not afraid to suggest things. Some might say I was a little bossy as a server. But when someone comes into a restaurant and wants their experience, that always makes me a little sad because you're in, like, for example, you're in Bouvet, you're in a really special space which Jody has created and all the servers are recreating all the time. And I think it is nice to give yourself over to that mm-hmm. and trust it.
Right. Thinking about Danny Meyer and waiting tables and being an artist, if you were moving to New York now, or let's say in a couple of years, if we are moving toward eliminating tipping, would you still be able to support yourself? Like, what does this mean on the server level?
Oh, big question. And I'm thinking about the increase of the tipped wage and all of those repercussions that will be coming mm-hmm. in the next year. It's a really interesting time. I've always thought that the wage disparity between front of house and back of house needed to be addressed, and I am not attached to tipping culture. So, yes, I think I would be able to support myself. I think that it will ultimately benefit the industry, mm-hmm. but that we're going to go through a bumpy transition, which is that people have always associated restaurant work with quick money.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was waitressing in the 90s, I was taking home almost $300 on a lunch shift. It was crazy.
That's amazing. But already since then, the days of walking out with cash in your pocket don't exist anymore. Most places following the rules don't have cash tips. But it's a different industry, and hopefully the level of professionalism and the benefits that go along with having a paycheck, mm-hmm. Hopefully it all rises together, but remains to be seen. It's going to be a big transition.
Okay, great. Last question.
Yeah.
If sweet bitter could be one dish, what would it be?
Plate of oysters. Easy, easy.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sermon. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday. And if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.